We are a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization, but we do have certain expenses to maintain. So to defray those, we charge a $5 admission to the lecture. And Mr. Jack Youngkin, the gentleman right two tables back here, will take your admission on the way out if you didn't get to see him on the way in. And if you want to become a regular, we have 6-month subscriptions for $35, which is almost a half-price deal if you're going to be a regular. And our format, for those not familiar with it, is we have a lecture of about 45 to 60 minutes, and we ask that you kind of hold your comments during that period and give the speaker a chance to get through to his end, and then we will have about 30 minutes of Q&A after that. I will moderate and recognize people and ask you to kind of state a question rather than make a speech, and that has some interconnection with the topic of the evening. And we're going to try to give everybody a chance to ask a question before we go back for a second. So I may permit a follow-on, but not 3 or 4 or 5 follow-ons. Make sure you settle your tab with L. Phoenix on your way out. And if they don't find you with your check, find them, because you know what you have, and be generous with your wait staff. They work hard for us to serve us, and I think that's about all the announcements other than our upcoming lecture tonight, which will be presented by Dr. George James of the University of North Texas, who's returning to the Philosopher's Forum lectern. He's a native of Vancouver, British Columbia, and did his graduate philosophy work at Columbia University in New York before coming to the University of North Texas. And he'll be speaking to us tonight on the topic of the role of philosophy and religion and environmental issues in India. Dr. James.
Thank you. I need to apply myself to my briefcase where I have my notes, and also a little handout that I think will help us visualize the region of India that I'm going to be talking about. Okay, do I need to turn this thing up?
No, you can't turn it up. Just you're good. You can just slide it up your lapel a little bit.
Slide up my lapel. Let me find my notes first, and then we'll take it from there. I know they're in here somewhere. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
You want to hear me okay? Does this thing rise a little bit?
We can turn it up a little bit.
Okay, while we're doing that, let me just pass out a little handout here. It's a little map on India that I there's 30 copies there. It should be plenty. I was going to do a PowerPoint. Thank you.
Like that?
That's perfect. I was going to do a PowerPoint, but this is the last week of classes, and things get chaotic at the university, and I just didn't get time to do all I wanted to do. So at the last minute, I decided, well, at least I'll Xerox this map and pass it out to you so that you'll have some idea what I'm talking about. And what I want to talk about tonight is an environmental movement in India, one that has gotten quite a bit of attention internationally, and it's almost become a term that people know about, because we often hear the term tree huggers, which is sort of a pejorative way of referring to persons who are concerned about the environment. So what I want to talk about tonight is a movement that could genuinely be called a movement of tree huggers, because these people actually did hug the trees in order to shield them from the axe that was intended to cut the trees down. And this movement started around 19, actually it started, according to the two historians that have made the most of this movement in terms of their careers, It was March of 1973 that it all began. But there's a number of things that happened prior to that that needs to be understood in order to really grasp what it all means. And what I'm interested in this movement, since I'm a historian of religion a philosopher of religion, is the sense in which the religious ideas of the Hindu religious tradition played a part in their concern for the forests. What had happened is that the strategy for forest industries was that the government, and this is in post-colonial times after independence, government would auction large stands of timber to companies that would exploit them, basically clear-cut timber in order to use that timber for pulp and paper, for various articles made of wood. Sometimes these trees are internationally considered very valuable, and so this was a cheap way of dealing with that. So I want to, first of all, give you some background to this movement that came to be called the Chipko Movement. Have any of you heard of this movement called the Chipko Movement? Well, this is good. Because Chipko is a Hindi and Garhwali word, which means to hug. And the strategy was to hug the trees when the axemen came to cut them down. Now, it has a long background, and so I need to paint a little bit of the background of these people in order to really understand, in order to enable you to understand what this movement was all about. The map that I passed out, and I regret that I don't have a full map of India with this, but if you were, you all kind of know where Delhi is in India, right? It's in the north of India. We think of Delhi, we think of India as sort of a diamond shape, you know, with peninsular India actually covering about half of the land mass, and then the region north of that, and Delhi would be in the middle of the region north of that. So if you were to travel by train or by car about 8 hours north of Delhi, you would be in what some people call the foothills of the Himalayas, or the Himalayas, as it's called in the United States. The largest mountain range and oldest, the newest mountain range on the face of the planet. Also, it has the largest accumulation of ice and snow in the world outside of the polar ice caps. And the region that we call the foothills of the Himalayas, this region here is bound on one side by China, and on the east by Nepal, and in the west by Himachal Pradesh, which is a much more mountainous state, and in the south by Uttar Pradesh. Now, Uttar Pradesh and this region that we're talking about today, Uttarakhand, was actually one state up till about 10 years ago, and then it was actually distinguished from the plains. And one of the reasons why it was split into two states is that the economy of the plains is very, very different from the economy of the mountains. And because industries in the plain had been in the habit of exploiting the mountains and the people of the mountains, they felt that their fortune would be better off if they were an independent state. And so that was established, as I said, about 10 years ago. Now, the people who live here speak a language that is closer related to Hindi. It's called Garhwali. And sometimes this region is called the Garhwal Hills. Sometimes it's called Terry Garhwal. And this region has been sort of an independent, that is culturally independent region for a very long time, perhaps 500 years. And so its culture is different from what you find on the plains, and its culture is different from what you find in other parts of the Himalayas. So to really understand what's going on here, it's useful to give a little bit of the geographic and cultural context in which this movement took place. There was a study of this region and a study of peasant resistance in this region by a very good scholar named Ram Guha, who I'm personally acquainted with. He wrote a book called, I'm trying to remember the name of the book, The Unquiet Woods. And the subtitle was Peasant Resistance in the Himalayas. So this region is called the Himalayas, though we don't have the high peaks of the Himalayas in this region. The mountains in this region range from about 3,000 to about 7,000 feet in height. So in Guha's study of this region, he points out that there are three factors that make this region quite different from the rest of India. In the first place, he points out that along the river valleys of the Garhwal Himalayas, the cultivation of wheat, rice, and millet was severely limited by the slope of the land and by the difficulty of irrigation. Nevertheless, he notes that with hard work, the people of this region, through the entire 19th century, harvested 2 and sometimes 3 harvests of grain per year. And they were very successful because they worked very hard. With an usual 6-month supply of grain stock and a diet supplemented by fish, fruit, vegetables, and animal flesh, Guha finds strong support for the claim in the 19th century of Henry Ramsay, the commissioner of the region from 1856 to 1884, that the hill cultivators were, quote, probably better off than any peasantry in India. He comments that European travelers to the region, and there weren't many, but there were a few, were frequently given to lyrical descriptions of peasant life in the mountain villages, comparing them often to those rural areas of England and Ireland, the very beautiful region. Guha observes, secondly, that the landed tenure system which the British inherited differed significantly from what we find in the plains. He notes with interest the observation of G.W. Traill, the first commissioner of the region, this is in British times, that at least 3/4 of the villages actually had proprietors who were also the cultivators of the land. In Terry Garhwal, the holding of land was by hereditary rights. It could be gifted to religious endowments or leased to tenants, but according to Guha, there were very few large landholders, such as you find on the plains. Rather, he says, the agrarian system was dominated by peasants cultivating their holdings with the help of family labor. The texture of colonialism in the hills thus differed significantly from the more characteristic features on the plains. The absence of a class of feudal intermediaries reinforces, he says, the image of an independent peasantry firmly in command of its resources. That's important. Comparing these hills to the stratified villages of the plains, he finds it close to the peasant political ideal in which the king and the peasantry are the only significant social forces. A third characteristic of this region is also very important for understanding what happened in the Chipko movement. In the difficult terrain of the hills, according to Guha, a single economic activity was usually insufficient to sustain a family household. The typical Garhwali household was supported by a variety of economic pursuits that required the equal participation of women. Here he cites the work of Ramesh Chandra, who states that the work of women in the hills was no less valued than that of men. With the exception of plowing, there was virtually no activity that the wife did not do. Guha also asserts that in addition to her work in the fields, women were also exclusively responsible for the household chores of cooking and cleaning, the rearing of children, and the collecting of fuel, fodder, and water for domestic needs. These observations support one very general reflection of the most visible exponent of the Chipko movement, the person that I've been researching and writing about for the last 10 years. His name is Sundarlal Bahugana. He says that before, During and since the colonial period, the people of the hills were and remain an extremely hard-working and productive people. Reflecting on his own accumulated knowledge of the region, he states that prior to industrial and economic expansion into the region, the people of the hills were happy, healthy, and prosperous. Now, I have gone into that much detail, and I could go into a lot more detail, because among people who are writing about the Chipko movement today, there is an effort to sort of debunk the idea that the Garhwali people were living in an earthly paradise. Now, I'm not saying it's anything like an earthly paradise. It was very, very hard work, but they were a very hard-working people, and they made a living from those rather hostile conditions. So when did the problems begin? Well, the problems began with colonialism. During the 19th century, the British had taken a strong interest in the forest resources of India. Early in the 19th century, the teak forests of Malabar, that's the west coast of India, were a vital resource for the burgeoning shipbuilding industry in the British Isles. By the middle of the 19th century, the hardwood trees of the Himalayas proved essential for the expansion of British commerce and industry in India, facilitated by a far-reaching railway network. But the building of railways required a colossal supply of timber for the railway ties. While the supply of timber for this purpose was soon stressed in other parts of India, the region of Terry Garhwal, with its abundant forests of deodar trees — these are beautiful trees related to the California cedar — proved opportune. Bahugana himself told me that the exploitation of timber in the princely state of Terry Garhwal began in the 19th century with the career of a young British soldier who abandoned his position in the colonial armed forces to seek his fortune in the hills. Another scholar, in his book, The History of Forestry in India, states that in 1840, and for a very nominal fee, this man, whose name was Frederick Wilson, received a lease on the forests of the Terry state, including the Yamuna and Bhagirathi valleys that permitted the shooting of wild game and the exploitation of its products. For the years 1850 to 1864, the state renewed this lease and extended it to include timber from this region. Guha refers to this young man, Frederick Wilson, as a pioneer in the water transport of timber, one of the real innovative moves of the forest industry in the 19th century, something that was done all over the world, including my region of British Columbia. The idea of felling trees into the rivers so that the rivers would then carry them down to the mouth of the rivers where they could be processed and so on. That was done in India too. And this guy, Frederick Wilson, was the guy that got it all started. In 1865, after his lease expired, the government of what was then called the Northwestern Provinces negotiated with the British a 20-year lease for all the forests of the state for an annual fee of 10,000 rupees. That would not be a lot of money, by the way. It would be about 10,000 rupees in those days. Would have been about a couple hundred dollars. This agreement was renegotiated with further provisions for another 20 years in 1885 and then again in 1905. But these agreements were intended to facilitate the extraction of timber for railway ties, and for that reason, the agreements that were made tended to restrict the rights of local people to utilize the forest for their own domestic needs. Needs for food, fodder, fuel, fertilizer, and fiber. Guha says, "At the time when the rate of forest destruction imperiled further railway expansion, the forest of Terry Garhwal proved a strategically valuable resource for British colonialism." In fact, government management of these forest resources developed only after the logging and river transport of timber was already in place. And when forest management did come into being, it was basically for the purpose of providing an adequate reproduction of revenue-producing species, rather than ensuring the rights of the forest people. Moreover, increasing commercial forest management by the state reduced the traditional access of the village people to the forest. These dynamics constituted a significant feature of the tension between the interests of the newly formed Indian Forest Department and the State Forest Department, under that authority, that administered the forest resources for commercial purposes rather than for the needs of the local people. So, while the expansion of the timber industry in the 19th century gradually depleted the variety of the forest cover the hills and restricted the local access to the forests, the middle of the 20th century brought new perils to the forests and the interests of the local people. So, what happened in the 19th century is largely, we can blame the British if you like, it's largely their exploitation of the forest resources and the utilization of forest resources at the cost of local people that was part of their agenda. But the question arises, well, what about after independence? Why would this continue after independence? You would expect that once the British are overthrown, that the exploitation of forests would not go on. Well, it wasn't quite that simple. For one thing, there was a war with China in 1963 that justified the development of motor roads to the border regions of the country. So if you look at that map that I passed out, all of those regions were areas where roads were built to the edge of China, to the edge of Nepal. And so the presumption was that with these motor roads, there would be the opportunity for economic development among these villages. But what materialized was the opportunity for further exploitation of the Himalayan environment and the exploitation of the people. The forests of chir pine, which was a species considered economically unprofitable in the 19th century, was now being cut for timber. Economic opportunists also found a resource in the sap of the chir pine that could be turned to profit in the production of turpentine. So this region became one of the largest exporters of turpentine in the 19th century. And then other forest products as well. Other species of trees could bring profit to businesses on the plain. And they were now available at considerably lower cost because you had motor roads going up right up to the borders. What did this mean for the villages? What did this mean for the village people? For the villages, the problem was that the new industries were conducted by business people and government bureaucrats who had no interest in the welfare of the local people. Contractors negotiated with the state government for rights to cut timber and tap resin. And the contractors came to the hills with their own labor force to execute these contracts. Employment in the hills remained scarce because the contractors hired labor from outside the region. And they did so for two reasons. One is that they had more access to people on the plains. And secondly, by bringing people from the plains to this region to cut down the trees, they felt no emotional connection with the forest like the local people would have done. So there was a calculated strategy. So with the motor roads now going into this area, there was another threat that emerged because the local people were not only were the holders of resources that were useful to industries on the plain, but they were a good market for the selling of alcohol. And when people are unemployed and depressed, it's a great market to sell alcohol. So there were a lot of alcohol shops that were opened in this region. Now, so we're talking now about the 1960s and 70s. And by now, this whole region is economically stressed. There's no or very few jobs. And what emerges, of course, is what Sunderlal Bahuguna calls a money order economy, where young married men would leave their families, go to the plains to get jobs, and then they would send their money orders back to their families to provide them with the necessities of life. But it means that the family is basically broken up. I could even testify from my own experience. When I'm in Delhi, I stay in a hotel where the night clerk works and has for as long as I've been going to that hotel, which is about 20 years. And he's actually from Nepal, but the situation there is not much different from what it is in the Garhwal Himalayas. He goes home for 1 month of the year. That's when he sees his children and his family. You know, the rest of the time, he's making a living for them, working as a night clerk in a small hotel in Delhi. And this is the plight of many, many people, particularly at this period of time in the 70s. Now, to this situation comes two women who are very, very important for what happens in the development of this movement against forced exploitation. These were two female disciples of Gandhi. If you've seen the movie Gandhi, you may remember the woman who was frequently with him, who was a European disciple of his, and her name was Mirabeen. And there was another woman whose name was Sarabeen. Ben, of course, is a Gandhian term, which means sister. In the Gandhian movement, brothers, men were called Bhai, which means brother, and women were called Ben, which means sister. So, and Gandhi himself was called Bapu, which means father, and his wife was called Ba, which means mother. And so there was a sense of family connection within that whole movement, and still today Gandhians refer to themselves and to their colleagues that way. I find that kind of interesting. But I'd like to say a little more about both of these people. The person who comes to be called Mirabeen was actually born in London, and she was the daughter of a very famous he becomes admiral of the East Indies fleet of the British Navy. His name was Sir Edmund Slade, and her name was Madeline Slade. She was born in 1892 and grew up in a very privileged environment, of course, being the daughter of an admiral. And she was particularly interested in music. Hadn't heard of Gandhi yet. But because she had the means, she went to Switzerland to have an interview with the latest biographer of Beethoven. And being a biographer, he was not interested just in Beethoven, though his biography of Beethoven is very scholarly and very interesting. He had just completed another biography of Gandhi. As I said, she had not heard of Gandhi at this time. So at age 30, she heard about Gandhi. And when she got the book that he had just published, when she had the interview with him, the book was still in press, and she was in the middle of a tour then, all the way to Egypt and back. And on her way back, the book was in print, and she bought it and read it in a single day, and then came to the conclusion that she was called to go to India to be of any kind of assistance she could to Gandhi in this struggle for independence. And she also immersed herself in the writings of Gandhi after reading his biography and learned about Gandhi's idea of Gram Swaraj, that is, village independence. The word Swaraj, Raj, of course, means rule, and Swaraj means self-rule. And the word Swaraj in Gandhi's thought and in his rhetoric meant independence from any people, or home rule, if you like. But the actual connotation of it, as it's developed in Gandhi's thought, is much more profound and much deeper than that, because he was not interested simply in independence, that is, India's liberation from the UK, What he was interested in is self-rule, meaning that every human being should be self-ruled. And of course, if you know anything about Hinduism, you know that Hinduism makes a distinction between the inner self, which they call Atman, and the visible self, which we identify with the body. And so he said that if political independence is going to become a reality in India, you first have to start with Swaraj at the individual level, at the family level, at the village level, at the block level. I'll be referring to blocks later. Block was actually a political designation of about 100 villages, not as large as a district. But then each unit should be self-ruled. And by self-rule, he meant not only self-governing, but independent, that is, self-sustaining. So he believed that every village should be able to produce what it needs for its own food, shelter, and clothing. Now you might say, well, that's kind of unrealistic in today's world. Well, a lot of people thought it was unrealistic in his day as well. But one of the reasons why he promoted the idea of the spinning wheel is he believed that every individual can spin their own cloth, and if they spin their own cloth, they can be economically independent of Britain. And so instead of buying textiles, which were actually cheaper when they're produced in the mills, textile mills of the Midlands, you know, India would, the British would take cotton from India to Britain, change it into textiles, and then sell it back to India. And Gandhi said, we've got to break that cycle of dependence. We've got to be economically independent if we are ever going to achieve political independence. So he believed that if you can have Swaraj at the individual level, at the family level, at the district level, at the village level, at the district level, at the state level, then political independence would come about as a matter of course. And he was not really quite happy with India when it finally achieved independence from Britain. He felt that the Swaraj of his dreams said this one day before he was assassinated. The Swaraj of my dreams has not yet come about. Because though we are politically independent, we are not economically independent. Well, Madeleine Slade studied all of these ideas and, of course, eventually went to India. She first corresponded with Gandhi. And he eventually invited her to come to India to be a part of this movement. And she did so. She sailed from Britain and arrived on November 6, 1925, and arrived in Bombay, what's now called Mumbai, and what was originally called Mumbai. And she was greeted there by colleagues of Gandhi, who suggested that she should spend the night there before making the train journey to Ahmedabad, where his ashram was. But she said, no, I'm ready to go now. So she immediately took a night train to Ahmedabad, and there the following day met the man whose dreams and whose hopes had become her own. Now, she spent a lot of time with Gandhi, and as I said, if you saw the movie Gandhi, you're aware that she became his personal secretary for a good part of her career. She immediately entered into the life of the ashram, learned how to do spinning and carding, and would accompany Gandhi on his khadi tours to villages where he was trying to perpetuate these ideas at the village level. And eventually she was arrested with Gandhi and went to prison with him, and Gandhi's wife and Gandhi's right-hand man, whose name is Desai, and was finally released from there in 1944 with Gandhi. His wife had died, and his right-hand man, Desai, had also died in prison. But with that, she decided that she was now going to try to, in her own way, implement the ideas that Gandhi had of village Swaraj, or village independence. And the region she chose was the Western Himalayas. And so she went there and began immediately to try to establish an ashram, very much along the lines of ashrams that he had established elsewhere. And in her travels there and in her work there, she became acquainted with a very young man who was only 22 at the time. She was in her 50s by now. And he had been initiated into Gandhi's constructive movement at the age of 13 by a Gandhian activist named Sridev Suman. Sridev Suman died in prison when he was 17. And just before that time, Sundarlal Bahugana himself was arrested, and he spent about 6 months in a police lockup, not even a proper prison, but just the kind of holding cell that the local police department would have. And by the time he came out of there, he was very sick. But making a long story short, he survived that experience and went underground for a year in what is today Pakistan, at the Pakistani side of Punjab. And after independence, came back to the Garhwal Hills and became the secretary of what is called the Prajamandal, or the People's Council. You also need to know that in this period of time, you sometimes think that, you know, you're seeing the movie Gandhi, you think that the British flag went down and the Indian flag went up overnight. But in fact, at that time, India was divided into many, many princely states, Terry Garhwal being one of them. And the princely states themselves had the option of joining the Indian Union or not. Of course, many of them were resistant to it. But many of them had peasant movements going around, going on around them to the point that they could hardly resist it. And Sundarlal Bahugana, who, as I said, was 22 years old then, was very much involved in this movement against the king of the state of Terry Garhwal. He first wanted to have democratic reforms, and there was a great deal of resistance to that, and finally they wanted to have to basically overthrow the king and become part of the Indian Union. So it was during that period of time that he met this woman, Meriben, and sort of became apprenticed to her. And he still looks back on those days as very formative days in his own upbringing, in his own discovery of his own vocation in life. So he learned a lot from her. She particularly became concerned about the ecology of the hills, because she could see that the planting of revenue-producing species was really not good for the Himalayan environment. The native species of Himalayan oak, called bunj, was particularly good for the ecology of the hills because it had an intricate network of roots that would hold the water. You know, in India you have rain for only 3 months of the year, and that kind of species really holds the water, so that the soil of the Himalayas is sort of like a sponge, which just holds the water very well and provides streams and springs that provide water for a good part of the rest of the year. So she was beginning to write about those kinds of issues when he met her. And of course, he was already involved in the independence movement. By now, independence had occurred. But he was also very much aware of the degradation of the environment in this region. And his principal strategy was to take what he called padyatras, or foot marches into the hills, to explain Gandhi's idea of Swaraj, explain the idea that every village could be economically independent. And so he was doing this with the encouragement of Sarla Benn. The other person who came to this region was also an Englishwoman of German descent. Her name was Catherine Mary Heilemann. She was born in England in 1901. And she also had correspondence with Gandhi. She first heard about India from student colleagues of hers at the university in London, and heard about the independence movement. And so was very interested in Gandhi's work and Gandhi's thought. And she thought she would like to go to India too, though she had no idea of who Meriben was. But she wrote to Gandhi, and Gandhi, it's interesting, wrote back and discouraged her from coming, because she said, he said that Westerners who come to India often have difficulty with the food, with the climate, with malaria, and he basically said, don't do it. but she went anyway because somebody else who she had corresponded with was undertaking a new school in Rajasthan, and they needed somebody with her gifts and with her capabilities, and so she went there to Rajasthan and eventually did meet Gandhi. By then, she was having a good deal of difficulty with malaria, and Gandhi recommended to her that she go to the hills as well, because when you're 4,000 feet above sea level, there are no mosquitoes. And so her purpose was a little different from the purpose of Mirabai. Her background was also quite a bit different from Mirabai. She did not come from a privileged background like Mirabai did. But she was particularly concerned with the sisters and daughters of the freedom fighters who were largely responsible for the achievement of independence in India. And she wanted to start an ashram, basically, for the education and empowerment of Himalayan women. Now, this relates to the fact that, as I said earlier, through the whole 19th century, the role of women was very strong among the in the Western Himalayas, and the work of women was very much valued. It was really with the impact of industry and commerce from the plains that that role was sort of interrupted. So, she began a school and an ashram in a place called Kasani, which was quite a bit east of where Sundalal Bhubana was. And she had a student whose name was Vimla Natyal, very, very intelligent, very promising, very, very capable. And she saw that this young girl could perhaps be the one who would take over for her when she was no longer capable of leading this ashram. There's a story attached to this. I can't get into all the details of it, but one of the things that the ashram did was to go to villages and put on plays illustrating ideas from Gandhi's thought, and also talking about the peril of alcohol. And it's interesting that on one occasion they came to Terry, where Sundalal was, and Sundalal was already the secretary of the Prajamandal there, and so the Prajamandal, of course, was very supportive of this movement that had begun in Kasani, and they were basically entertaining this troupe of actresses that had come from there to put on a play for the village. And on that occasion, now, I should point out that Sundalal's father had died, his mother had died when he was very young, and so his life was sort of dominated by his elder brother. Vimla was also from that region, and her father happened to be sitting in the audience next to Sundalal's elder brother, and the two of them got to talking about the possibilities that perhaps these two young people should meet. Making a long story short, they did meet. They did fall in love, and they were married in the year 1956. And at that time, Sundalal did what Gandhi had recommended anybody concerned with India should do, and that is go to a remote village and try to establish that village as an economically and politically independent entity. And so the two of them went to a remote region in the Western Himalayas, a place called Siliara. And they started an ashram there, very much in line on the model of the ashram that Sullivan had started in Kasani. So this was an interesting development in itself. And Vimla and Sundalal Bhubana became very, very strong supporters of this Gandhian ideal of constructive work at the village level, and were very much involved in the movement against alcohol. Very similar, it would make it a very interesting comparison to compare that movement against alcohol in the Western Himalayas with the movement against alcohol in the United States. It would be very interesting. And the movement against alcohol in Britain was interesting too, because it also occurred just at the time that factory-made alcohol was being perpetuated, just as it was in the hills of the Western Himalayas. That movement, by the way, finally resulted in a ban on alcohol outlets in 5 districts of the Western Himalayas, all bordering China and Nepal. So they consider that one of the great accomplishments of that early movement. But Sunderlal was also aware, so they were concerned basically with 2 things. One was the establishment of an independent economy at the village level, and that meant to provide jobs at the local level for village men, particularly. But the other thing was the condition of the environment itself on which the local people depended for their livelihood, because they needed the forest for food, fodder, fuel, etc., etc. And what was happening is that these industries from the plains would come into the region with their own labor force, clear cut, and leave. And the local people are left, and by the way, most of their men are on the plains making a living. So they're left with devastated forests that are no longer providing food, water, fuel, etc. And so their economy is in very, very bad condition. So what Sunderlal did, and several of his colleagues did, was to form village-level organizations, actually block-level organizations, to basically wrest the opportunity for industrial development away from the corporations and get it into the hands of the local people. So at this stage in his career, and this was still in the 60s, he believed that the best future for the local people would be to undertake sustainable forestry, that cut down trees, yes, but do so in a way that will employ local people. But as time went on, he began to see that it really made no difference whether the trees are being cut by local people to enable them to make a living, or cut by workers from corporations from the plain, because the trees were being cut down anyway, and the result was devastation for the local economy. And so in the year 1978, he actually changed his viewpoint and became what we would call an ecologist. That had largely to do with his meeting with another man in this period of time, whose name was Sir Richard St. Barbe Baker. He was a forester who had gone around the world addressing the problem of the loss of forest cover, and made a famous statement that I still think is interesting today when we hear about global warming. We hear a lot about strategies to cut down the increase in greenhouse gases. We don't hear too much about planting of trees. But his view was that the tree cover of the earth is like the skin of a human being. If you cut away a third of the skin of a human being, the human being is not going to survive, nor could the planet survive with a third of its forest cover gone. And so he went around the world trying to motivate people and start programs to plant trees. It would be very interesting to find out, to see what the legacy of his work was this many years later. But Sunderlal was very much influenced by him and argued that the trees should be allowed to grow because they provide things that are needed at the local level, not only food, not only fuel, but fiber and fodder, which is a very important thing, fodder for cattle. This whole region was not a particularly agricultural area. They did very limited agriculture, largely to grow crops to feed the animals. It was largely a culture of animal husbandry. So the movement that comes to be called the Chipko movement had largely to do with one of these organizations, which was founded by one of the colleagues of Sunderlal Bahuguna, and it was called the Dashali Gram Swarajya Sangh. Dashali was the region. Gram means village. So Dashali was a block, a group of about 100 villages. And Swarajya means self-rule, and Sangh means organization. So you had several of these Sanghs, or Swarajya Sanghs, in this region, all of which could be credited to Sunderlal Bahuguna. Not all of them were actually begun by him. One of them, the Dashali Gram Swarajya Sangh, was actually begun by one of his followers named Chandi Prasad Pad. Anyway, the confrontation that comes to be the birthplace of the Chipko movement occurred in 1973 in the spring, when this local organization applied to the State Forest Department for permission to fell 5 ash trees. Ash trees were very important for the local economy for 2 reasons, according to Sundala Bhuguna. One is that it was a light wood, which is also very durable, which is why it's used for making baseball bats today, and tennis rackets, and other things, and cricket bats. That was a big deal in India. The other thing was that it provided fodder. It had provided a lot of leaf litter, and it provided a good deal of fodder for the cows that were kept by the Himalayan people. So together they were a considerable concern, and they wanted, they were going to cut 5 of them. That's very sustainable, But the government refused their request, but at the same time granted request to a company from Ahmedabad, which is in the hills, Allahabad, which is in the hills, which is on the plains, to cut an entire forest of ash trees for sporting purposes. So you can see that this was something that wasn't going to sit well with the local people. And so the members of the Dashali Gram Swarajya Sangh got together to decide what to do. And there's 2 versions of what was actually decided. One, according to one historian of the movement, whose name was Thomas Weber, an Australian, with whom I've had some interesting correspondence, he argues that, according to one version of the story, the local activists were getting together to decide what to do about this gross injustice of the government giving an entire forest of ash trees to a corporation to fell when they wouldn't give them 5 trees for local needs. And so Chandra Prasad Bhatt, according to this version, said, "Let them know that they will not, we will not allow the felling of the ash trees. When they aim their axes upon them, we will embrace the trees." The word Chipko was used in that statement. The other version of the story claims that during one of their discussions, a village woman stood up and said, "When a leopard attacks a child, the mother takes his onslaughts on her own body." Then after a brief silence, she shouted, "That's it. We'll hug the trees when the Simmons Company comes to cut them." And so this strategy of hugging the trees began. Now, of course, this whole movement is being explored by all kinds of historians, and everybody wants to deconstruct it and reconstruct it and eliminate the mythologies that have arisen from it. So there's a lot of talk about what actually happened in those days and how many people actually did hug the trees. I've talked to people who actually did hug the trees, so I know that at least some people did. But the point is that they threatened to hug the trees and that they were willing to do that in order to save the trees from being felled. Now, it began in that particular forest near the city of Gopeshwar, town of Gopeshwar. And we're told that the agents of the Simmons Company finally were forced to retreat, to depart from the forest without felling a single tree, simply because you had so many people there hugging the trees, that they finally felt that they were defeated. But the problem is that the government policy didn't change with this. The annual government auction of forests continued in November 73. And even prior to that, the Simmons Company was given another plot of land at another location. Of course, the local people heard about that and went there to hold a large protest and managed to succeed in stopping the felling of trees there. So all over this region, there were many, many places where this movement occurred. And on the map I've shown you, you can see where Gopeshwar is, Rudraprayag, Chamoli, Joshima. All of these places were places where the Chipko movement was very much in evidence. I would like to talk about, because I'm probably running out of time here, how are we doing? Almost running out of time.
Yeah.
I'll tell you about one that's particularly interesting to me. If you look where you see the Ganges River flowing down from Gumbu, there's one place called the Advani Forest, just south of Terry. And then right next to it, on the other side of the river, there's the Salat Forest. It was interesting that the women of that region gathered to have a vigil in that forest. By that year, 1977, I think it was, those trees in that forest, and it's interesting that in British Columbia, where I'm from, and I worked for the British Columbia Forest Service during the summers when I was in college, it was interesting that the timber sales were designated by compass bearings and by longitude and latitude, whereas in India, forests are designated by names. So they refer to the Salat Forest or the Advani Forest and so on. So the Advani Forest was going to be cut. And the local people got word of it, the Chipko movement heard about it, and they organized a protest. And women from 15 different villages met in that forest and on the road, in the pathway into the forest, to prevent the men from coming there and cutting the trees. And during that time, they read from the Hindu scriptures, basically as kind of a way of finding support in Hindu thought and Hindu practice for their activism. A lot of people have talked about whether Hinduism is eco-friendly or whether Christianity is eco-friendly or whether Buddhism is eco-friendly. It's really hard to answer that question when it comes to Hinduism because it's a tradition of 5,000 years. But it is interesting to ask the question, more interesting, I think, to ask the question of what kind of support did people who protested the exploitation